Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Hello, I'm Peter Johnson. Thank you for your patience whilst we took a little break. We've all been slightly distracted from the podcast. However, we're now back and preparing lots of new content for you. Like all of our programmes, we try to bring you original content that is not always covered elsewhere. And today we cover a topic which is pretty new to me, and that's a bit embarrassing, given that I live such a short distance from Middle Wallop. And I'm delighted to welcome Mike Peters, who's the joint author of the Authorised Operational History of the Army Air Corps. And today we'll be talking about Volume 1, Ops Normal, from 1957 to 2017. Mike's a former Army Air Corps officer, serving both as ground crew and as an air door gunner. During his 34 years, he served in Northern Ireland, Cyprus, Germany, Bosnia, Kosovo, both Gulf Wars, and Afghanistan. Mike's co-author is John Greenacre. He's also a former Army Air Corps officer and a Gazelle pilot with 23 years of service. He took part in operations in the Gulf, Balkans, and Northern Ireland. He's also served in Germany, Canada, the Falklands, and Kenya. Wow, with such an amazing amount of experience. Mike, welcome to Extended.
Hi, Peter. It's really good to be on the show.
Thank you so much for joining us. And as I said there, I'm slightly embarrassed for two reasons, really. The first one is I don't live a million miles away from Middle Wallop, so should know my Army Air Corps better than I do. But also, my brother served in the Army Air Corps. Many decades ago, for a short time as a trooper. So I should have known so much more than I did before reading the book, which is a fascinating read. But Mike, before we delve into hearing about the Army Air Corps, I'm really eager to learn more about your career. You know, those 34 years, that's a really long time in any profession. How did it all start for you?
Well, I did 34 years, you said, so I started when the Army Air Corps was still very much going through growing pains. I joined as a junior leader at 16 and a half years of age in 1980. And I enlisted in Chester and went into the Army. Always wanted to be in the Army Air Corps, in the Air Training Corps as a cadet. Flew gliders and flew chipmunks and all that, and was fascinated by Vulcans, Lightnings, Phantoms. But I always had a thing for World War II aircraft, but also for the glider pilot regiment and army flying, so army aviation, which was a bit even more niche back in those days. So if a scout helicopter turned up at an air show, or a Gazelle helicopter, or even one of the new shiny Lynx as they were in those days, I'd be the first in the queue to go and see them. So, you know, I joined and went to Bovington in Dorset and did my training, and I think it was only the third ever intake of junior leaders to go into the Army Air Corps. The Air Corps only really just started to take direct entry air crew. Up until that point, they'd been taken from all over the rest of the Army. So they were exciting times, and I went on as a ground crewman, as an air trooper to start with, and then through the ranks and all those places you mentioned, all those different campaigns. And for me, and for John as well, actually, it's the best time to be in the Army Air Corps, because it was expanding while the rest of the Army was reducing in size. There were all those different events in the Balkans, in Northern Ireland, and in the Middle East. And I was talking to someone today about it, saying it's the small parts of the Army that go everywhere: the postal and courier, the catering corps, the air corps, these combat support arms that you need everywhere, so that they're guaranteed to go, and they're the ones who rack up the medals and the experience.
It's quite fascinating, actually, to hear you mention Bovington again, probably 15 miles behind me here. My brother also passed out, I think, a year maybe after you, right. Down in Bovington. I remember coming down to watch him parade and pass out. And it's funny how the world can be such a small place sometimes. He also went through the junior leader process as well, which I'd completely forgotten about until you mentioned then. Tell us a little bit about how you ended up as air crew. How did that happen?
That's interesting, because the air door gunner, or the door gunners as they were before that, was always a locally employed thing. You know, the Army Air Corps never had proper like they do now, a proper career path where you could be an air crewman, you could be an observer, or you could be an air gunner, firing TOW missiles or SS-11 before that. But door gunners were a thing that, if you read the volume one that we've written, they were actually a thing right from the start. But they were like, okay, we don't need those anymore. We're going to go back to peacetime. There was no trade. There were no winch men or anything like that. So you would find yourself saying, oh, okay, you want to be air crew, so you go and be a local crewman. So I'd find myself in an Alouette 2 helicopter and flying up the buffer zone in Cyprus in the green zone, map reading in an Alouette. Or you'd find, so, okay, we need door gunners. And if you were keen and you had the training to use the GPMG machine gun, you were the guy to do that. And I first started doing that in Northern Ireland along with many other people. So, and then you come back from Northern Ireland and say, oh, we're not using door gunners in Germany. So you go back to your original job, which could be refueling, it could be rearming, it could be, as I was, a signaller working on armoured vehicles, you know, any of those things. So, but that's how you got an insight into what went on in a Lynx helicopter crew or right. a scout.
Yeah.
You looked over the shoulders of the pilot and the crew in the front, you learned about helicopter flying, and it was, you know, there's no better way to do it than that experience. And heli abseiling and door gunning and all those things you could do, it was really exciting, you know. And you compare that to some of your mates in other cap badges and say, what did you do this week? Well, I went to Brecon, or I was in the Welsh mountains mountain flying, I was door gunning on the ranges, you know, at such a low rank. And that's that enthused so many people to give the Air Corps what it was at the time and still is its USP, that NCO aircrew, NCO pilots, you know, the Navy and the Air Force insisted on officer pilots, and the Army is like, oh, if you've got the aptitude, you be a crewman, lance corporal or a corporal, you're a sergeant pilot, and on you went.
But is it true, Mike, that, again, going back to my brother's experience, your training, the training for everybody is exactly the same, the basic training, everybody goes through the basic training and through the same structure before you go into your specialist area. So you're a soldier first.
Yeah, you used to have three classifications, 3, 2, 1, and one being the higher one. And when you got to class one, you had to specialise. But before that, a class three, everyone refuelled, everyone could use a radio properly, everyone could rearm a helicopter, and that was the clerks. Anybody had to be able to do all this. And everyone had HGV to drive trucks. So you're multi-employable as an air trooper, which is great. You know, and if you're a junior leader, you had even more. You talk basic German and all these kind of different skills that you had. And you needed that. And in an Army Air Corps squadron, it was such a small organisation with so few ground crew, you had to be able to do everything. You got to class one soldier before promotion to lance corporal, and you specialised in either the signals path, comms, or the MT, where you went from specialising in rearming and refueling. That all changed with Apache.
Yeah.
Things got a bit more complicated.
Right.
Right.
And when did you leave the Army, Mike?
I left the Army 10 years ago. In fact, 2013.
Okay.
I was very lucky. My final spell, I was with the Apache Force at Wattisham. Then I got my last 2 years was at RAF Marham as the Army Liaison Officer for the Tornado Force.
Okay. Wow.
It was really great. You know, yeah. And the similarities were many.
Yeah. Okay. And tell me a little bit about your co-author, John Greenacre, his experience.
So John and I started working together about 20 years ago. We were in the same regiment. But John was originally RCT, Royal Corps of Transport, and he was Director Entry Officer. So whereas I went through the ranks to become an officer, John was into Sandhurst, into the academy.
Right,
came out into the RCT. He was a troop leader in Gulf War One. And got a lot of experience there. And then he went on and did his pilot's course and became a Gazelle recce pilot. And we met together in 3 Regiment Army Air Corps, served in Bosnia at the same time. And we both had a shared interest in military history and aviation history. And we both had an interest in glider pilot regiment and airborne, Arnhem, 1944, all that kind of stuff. And we find ourselves sharing an office at Wattisham in the very early days of the attack helicopter force. And we're both battlefield guides as well at weekends. So we take groups of people to Arnhem and to Waterloo and places like that. And so that's how we built this relationship, which allowed us to become co-authors for this project.
Yeah. So I'm really nervous to ask this, but why has it taken, I don't know who it should be, but why has it taken so long to write the authorised history of the Army Air Corps? Why has it taken to this
point? That's a really good question. That's a really good question. And to be frank, it's because the Air Corps has been so busy. I mean, it's formed on the 1st of September 1957. On that day, it's serving already on four simultaneous operations. And it's such a young corps, or it seemed such a young corps. It was so exciting, it's so dynamic, so much going on. There was no time. And people wrote small individual snapshot histories or big coffee table books or whatever. And we'd always both thought that when we left one day, we would do this. And then finally, the regimental headquarters, the Army Air Corps at Middle Wallops, it started to talk about some kind of history being written. And we were called down to a conference where what we rapidly realised was it was a gathering of potential authors.
Right.
Look around the room of the retired officers in the room. We were about 20 years younger than everyone else in the room. Right. So we were determined that we were going to do it because these are the guys who'd written all these previous histories, which, you know, were fine for what they were. But we wanted to write an operational history. So John and I volunteered for the guard room and said, we'll do this and we'll do it properly. And because John's now a doctor teaching history at the University of Suffolk. So he's all over the academic format for this, how it should be done, yeah, which is why it's produced the way it is.
Yeah.
And so we put ourselves forward and said, we'll do it. And this is our synopsis and this is how it should be. And we really wanted an operational history to get the story of the Corps, because the Corps, as the name suggests, has been on operations since its conception to now. It's permanently on operations.
Yeah. Yeah. But let me go back to come forward before we talk about the actual history of the Corps. Am I okay calling it the Corps, by the way?
Yeah.
How do you go about researching a topic as wide and as deep as this?
Yeah. So we thought it'd be quite straightforward. We've both written books before. John's written about airborne forces in World War II, so have I. You know, we thought, we're the right guys to do this. And of course, between us, we've done nearly 60 years in the Corps. We know the story. And actually what happened was we started to dig and we thought, wow, this is far more complex than we thought. Because in every campaign, the Army Air Corps, Army Aviation has been involved in every single one, and some of them is done on its own. And so there was such a depth of subjects and complexity of subjects that's why it took us a while. So we had the Army Flying Museum at Middle Wallop. There's a superb new archive there which has been done, and
yeah, it's brilliant.
Also, I want to give a shout out to the Airborne Forces Museum, Airborne Assault at Duxford as well. They had a lot of stuff as well, and we started to dig through there, and things like journals, war diaries, things that we knew about from before, and started to pull them all together and hang them on this synopsis, this template we had of what we thought the chronology should be, how it should be written. And we rapidly realised that this couldn't be done in a single volume as we'd originally been asked to do. And maybe even it might be three, but actually it turned out to be two now. And we had the skill set, but what really upset us was COVID. We were set to do it. We were commissioned before COVID. COVID came into that and stopped us getting to the archives. And then we also found that a lot of the squadrons and regiments are still sitting on the history. They haven't surrendered it to the museum at Wallop, to the archives. So it's still, there are still these big squadron scrapbooks sat in these different squadrons. You know, I was in 653 Squadron 9. I was the custodian of that scrapbook, and they're still there. They're not been handed over.
Yeah. Wow. So where does the title come from? Explain to the novices out there, Ops Normal.
So Ops Normal, quite early on, we said, well, we've got a title, we've got an idea. And I said to John, well, how about Ops Normal? Because that's the call, a radio call that a crew give when they're transiting from A to B to say, everything's fine, we're where we should be, the right height, right speed, the engines are working, we're not falling out of the sky. So Ops Normal is the call. And we've sort of twisted that to say operations are normal for the Army Air Corps. It's continual operations, and that's why it's an operational history. So it's the sand and the bullets and the aviation fumes that you get in this. Not this is how the buttons are on a tunic, and this is when this was formed. It's about the people on ops, the helicopters, the fixed wing, the transition between the two, all of that, and it's about the really nitty gritty business of Army aviation, and where it fits into the bigger picture of the Army and the armed forces.
Okay, so let's go back then to the beginning. How did the Army Air Corps come about?
Well, there are plenty of histories about what happened before, because this is the second Army Air Corps. The first Army Air Corps is a World War II organisation, and many people have been to Commonwealth War Graves cemeteries around the world and seen graves of glider pilot regiment or parachute regiment with Army Air Corps underneath those regimental titles. And so the original Army Air Corps is the SAS, the glider pilot regiment, the parachute regiment, and the artillery OP squads are tagged onto that. And it's an administrative organisation, but there was an Army Air Corps. That sort of fades away after World War II. But Army Aviation is retained in light aircraft squadrons right the way through. And then you get this moment before the Suez Crisis in 1956 where the Army is playing, and the RAF, and a bit to a certain extent the Navy, are all playing around with helicopters. And there's a joint experimental helicopter unit, and then that becomes a joint helicopter unit. And it's committed to the operations on for Suez, Operation Musketeer. So the Britain launches the first ever large-scale helicopter assault in history, and that's JHU, who were based at Middle Wallop, and that's 56, and that sort of seals the deal. It's like, because there's a bit of wrangling before between the Army and the RAF. The RAF's going down the unmanned aircraft rockets. And so we're not really interested in this. So the Army says, yeah, well, we can't afford it, but we're going to try and do it. So we're going to use amalgamate all the light aircraft squadron we've already got and flights around the world and going to have an Army Air Corps. And that happens officially on the 1st of September 1957. When the old glider pilot regiment flag comes down the day before, and up goes the new flag, the sky blue berry is introduced for the air crew, etc., and the new cap badge, which is a little bit of ceremonial stuff that we have got in their history, because that's like sets the tone for what follows and what the organisation is.
Yeah. And what is the thinking back in early mid-50s to bring in the Corps together? What was the Army's desired outcome? What was it after? Was it close air support? Was it supply? Was it observation? Where did the driver?
Well, really, it's as always. As take it back to the Royal Flying Corps in the Great War. You know, it's seen over the hill, and it's integral aviation that you control, and a soldier pilot who understands with the soldier on the ground. With the greatest respect to, you know, the Royal Air Force and all the other air forces I've worked with over the years, and as I said earlier, I was at Tornado Force for 2 years. You know, with the best will in the world, they think differently, and their understanding of what happens in an air assault operation or an armoured battle group is completely different. So what the Army wanted was something they could command and control themselves, something they could populate the cockpits of whatever aircraft they had themselves, and would be integral and part of the Army organisation. And that wasn't empire building, that was actually an operational capability, primarily at that stage, reconnaissance and observation, primarily, with a little bit of comms and communication and a little bit of light freight movement. But really, it was about having the ability to direct artillery fire, to carry out reconnaissance, and to work close in with armoured formations or infantry formations.
It's been an ever ongoing issue, hasn't it, between the various sectors of the MOD on who should control flying operations. I mean, we had a debate, you know, the Navy and the RAF, and we've seen, of course, with the F-35, the joint squadrons, and they still can't quite work out who does what to whom and what ego wins what bit. But the Army seems to have gently stolen its little toys, taken them away, and operated quite effectively on its own. Is that because the other two don't provide that capability, or is it because the Army can do it better itself?
It's a personal opinion, I think.
Yeah, it's fine.
There have been lots of Hardy perennial debate that comes around every defence review, and halfway in between each defence review is all the helicopters should belong to the Army, yeah, all of them, and all the jets and fixed wings should belong to the Air Force, and then you know, the Navy don't need that. And you've only got to look at the chapters we're writing now about Libya in 2017, where it's quite interesting. Volume one starts with Op Musketeer off Suez in 1956, with JHU flying from the HMS Ocean to launch a heli-borne assault. 2017, the new HMS Ocean has 65 Squadron flying their Apache helicopters. So naval platforms flying army helicopters into battle with no air force. So, you know, you can go around the houses for this forever, but, you know, the support helicopter force, the Chinook force, the relationship is much tighter than it used to be. Afghanistan did that, I think, you know, Chinook force and support helicopters, you know, it works. And I think everyone wants their own little slice of that. And it's always going to be about money. Yeah. And you can see the army lost its islanders, its defenders, they've gone, it's fixed. So the Army Air Corps no longer has any fixed wing.
And traditionally, you know, back in those early days, and you mentioned it earlier, most of the aircraft were actually fixed wing. You know, the light aircraft. And of course, the Auster has a big part to play in the early formation of the Corps. Before we talk about some of the operations, though, Mike, tell us how the book is structured, because before we launch into it, the way that you've written this volume and the next volume will explain some of the topics we want to discuss.
Yeah, so volume one is in print now. Volume two is in progress and will be out in by the end of this year. So the volume one really looks at Musketeer 1956 through to the end of the 70s, very early 80s, although topics like Northern Ireland, which run all the way through, will stretch across both volumes. But they are chronological chapters and they are separate campaigns. And we had a lot of debate about how to do this, but it's tidier, easier to follow if we did it the way we've done it, with critically lots of photographs that haven't been used before and good maps, because we both historians that are apoplectic when you pick up a history book and there's no map.
No, they're excellent. They really are good.
Where are we? When are we? So, yeah. And we found a lot of photographs thanks to the guys down in the archive at Middlewallop that haven't been used before, and also people have contributed themselves, veterans and serving personnel, said, "Oh, I've got this photo. It's just different. It's interesting." So we've used those. So the book is about each operation. It looks at how the Corps adapts, evolves and changes. And it is evolution rather than revolution as it goes, you know, and, you know, the different aircraft types from Auster to Beaver, from, you know, Scouts being the first attack helicopter through to you know, the Lynx entering service, you know. So, you know, and it's important to realise that the Air Corps in World War II, all the ground crew and mechanics were Royal Air Force. One of the things in Volume One is it's not a history of the Remy, but we do talk about the aircraft technicians.
Going to ask a question about the Remy, actually, because it's very close links, aren't they?
It's a big part of a standard Army Air Corps regiment is the Remy. It has a workshop rather than a light aid detachment, so it's a bigger slice. Because of the complexity of the aircraft themselves. So that's one of the limitations when the Corps first formed, is how can you – the Remy have to learn to maintain aircraft, which they weren't doing before the Corps was formed, and be allowed to do that and learn that skill set. And one of the things at the start in the opening chapters is this – disparate organization, all these different little empires that had operated independently, having to standardize for the sake of flight safety and spares control and all those mundane but vital admin things that keep aircraft flying safely. Flight safety.
It's quite fascinating, you know, you use the term evolution. I was going to ask a question about how the Corps had evolved, and it feels like when you read through the operations that it's been involved in, it's grown and evolved as much to respond to the UK's overseas crises in the old Commonwealth as much as operational requirements for a Cold War army, if that makes sense. It sort of had to respond and so developed A lot of its techniques, a lot of the aircraft attributes, you know, the training for the air crew, was driven by the operational requirements abroad as much as traditionally what we all think the Army Air Corps was so much more focused on, which was that sort of Cold War Germany, Europe focus. And I think it's quite interesting to see how you've managed to bring in all of those operational requirements into the evolution of the Corps itself.
Yeah, so that's quite right. And, you know, really the latter half of Volume 1 and all of Volume 2, that Cold War work is still going on. And, you know, that is the bread and butter work. And it is evolving along the same time. And the lessons that are learned in these early campaigns in Volume 1 about how to command and control an aviation unit, how to support it, except these things are all taken back to Germany, to the old inner German border, and evolve, you know, the missile systems, etc. They're learned. But you're quite right. There's this sort of reactionary way that the Corps and the Army has to evolve, because, you know, it's a cyclic thing. And it's quite funny. Some of the Afghanistan veterans who read Volume 1 have said, wow, we relearned that lesson in 2006 and 2007. And it's already been done in 1966. And they would say, yeah, forward operating bases were a thing before, you know, and air gunners were a thing before, and training and all these things that they've all happened before. And you know, the need for specially trained signalers in your command post, and, you know, all these things have happened before.
Did you know that the RP-3 rocket projectile, used to great effect by Hawker Typhoons in the tank-busting ground attack role, was originally conceived as an air-to-air weapon to attack Luftwaffe bomber streams? Did you also know that in the 1950s, an indigenous light aircraft built in the Philippines was skinned with woven bamboo matting? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal, print and digital, that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
G'day, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran from Plane Crazy Down Under.
And you're listening to Extended.
A lot of the chapters in the book are in environments that are hot and not always dry, but heat seems to be a common factor across. What sort of demands, before we talk about some of those operations, what sort of demands does that put on the Army, the air crews and the aircraft? Because from Borneo, you know, you go from the desert to the temperate forests. It's quite fascinating, actually, to see how they operated in all those different climates.
It's very interesting when you think that so many times the defense reviews or the MOD or the Army said we're never going to operate in those environments. And again, you know, we're here to do Germany. That's what we're here to. And I've stood in that hangar and been told that, you know, it's like, forget the desert. You'll never go there again. Months later, I found myself in Iraq again. But the aircraft weren't designed to operate in those environments. You know, the Scout, when it comes in, for example, is a brand new aircraft designed to operate in Germany and UK. And, you know, hot and high, dry and humid, operating at altitudes above the mountains in Aden. You know, and then hot and humid, you mentioned in Borneo and Malaya and these places. So these engines, these aircraft, were not designed to operate in that environment. You're in a little tiny flight in a new core, trying to quickly learn those lessons and adapt how you do things, you know, and the way the engines are serviced, etc. And you mentioned air crew, so the crews and the ground crew. And I speak from personal experience. You know, sitting in the bubble of a Gazelle helicopter in the heat of Kuwait or Iraq or Aden, it is a greenhouse, you know. And it's funny. I was interviewing one of the veterans for Operation Telic, the Iraq operation, and he gets out there in the summer of 2003 after the war's just finished, and for Telic 2, and it's so hot in the cockpit that, you know, they're wearing desert boots. They have to run to the aircraft because the asphalt is so hot, and the refuelers are standing on the skids, which I remember doing in the UN in Nicosia because the ground was too hot to stand on. And then, you know, the pilots are wearing camelbacks because unlike our fast jet brethren and people like that, we don't have aircon. So, we're in a flying greenhouse in the heat of the day in the Middle East. It's draining, absolutely draining.
It's quite interesting. It's almost like, dare I say this, Mike, there's a bit like a poor relation scenario in the Ministry of Defence. I'm not saying the other two services get away with anything special, but it almost feels sometimes like the army, well, you know, they're rough and ready, they'll get on with it. And I think a lot of that comes out in the book through circumstances, not the way you've written it, just the circumstances they've had to face, some of the tools and the initiative they used to overcome some of those challenges was quite fascinating. Let's talk about some of the places that the Army Air Corps operated, particularly in those early times then in through the book. You know, you mentioned Malaya, Borneo, Hong Kong, Cyprus. Tell us a little bit about some of those operations that they were involved in.
Well, I found some of the interesting ones. I mean, John's done some great chapters on Malaya and Borneo and the casualty rate in aircraft flying in those confined areas and introducing rotary aircraft in at the same time is a high. And it's about that learning curve we spoke about and the Indonesian confrontation and supporting Brunei. And the unit of currency of the Army Air Corps at the time is a flight, 4 to 6 aircraft or even less if you needed to. So you can easily deployable. You know, if you look at things like Rhodesia, monitoring force in Rhodesia when the 656 is sent out to Rhodesia, 660 squadron in Hong Kong, UN, Turkish invasion, all that, they're there for that. So it's easily deployable. It's integral to the organisation. But going back to your earlier point, which you eloquently put about inter-service rivalry, there's also the politics within the army of...
Right. Okay.
Who owns the helicopters?
Right.
There's lots of time with the armored corps said, yeah, we think we should have all the helicopters. We should control those. And there's that phase where we have the integrated air troops where the Army Air Corps can't afford to support itself. So the tank regiments and the infantry regiments are running around with their own little flights of helicopters flown by their own specially trained officers. And some take it seriously and use them in a proper recce role. Others use them as a CO's taxi service and, you know, different levels of professionalism are going on around that. But, you know, that you said at the start about withdrawal from empire and the brushfire wars that were going on. And the helicopters and fixed wing are ideal for that, you know, and you've got things like the de Havilland, that fantastic fixed wing aircraft, the de Havilland Canada Beaver. You know, that's the Army Air Corps fitted guns on it, waste guns on them in Aden, and you even used them to drop bombs at one point and to do para-resupply, all of which they were not supposed to do because that was an RAF role. Had to do that, you know. And so there's a host of operations in Aden where the utility of the helicopter becomes rapidly apparent to the special force community, special forces.
Yes, I was going to ask a question about that. Yeah.
So this relation that's gone on ever since where army helicopters are used by the SAS in the Middle East to do what they need to do. And some of the accounts that are in the Aden chapter are, you know, the Scout is fitted with 2 forward firing GPMGs and a waste gun. You know, and some of the stories are phenomenal of how people are, how close they get to the enemy in the support of the SAS. And of course, the medevac role makes all the difference. And I think that goes back to your point about having an integral force because, you know, the helicopters of the RAF are flying at the time are pretty fragile. You know, the Belvedere in Malaya. When the Belvedere comes out to Aden, there's a really big op that's put on right at the start. They're recalled halfway through the op. The RAF helicopters disappear. And the AOC in Aden at the time is Johnny Johnson of Battle of Britain fame. And the army have to go into his in-tray and say, you've just left the guys out on the mountain because the Belvedere is so vulnerable. So that's the start of the friction at the time, but they sort that out. So there are lots of different roles that the the Army, they really are cutting the teeth. And every time they make mistakes, they get better. They improvise. They evolve, as I said earlier. And it's also one of the biggest problems is the Army itself understanding how to use aviation.
Yeah, yeah.
And
there's some great. There's really great stories. Stories. Is that the right? Is that the right term? Apologies. I don't mean to belittle any of them, but there's some really great accounts of how aircraft are used in things like resupply. You mentioned the SAS. Real niche activities that could only be done by a very, very small force.
Yes.
A very, very focused force and a force that was under the control of the local commanders.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the difference. And there's a great quote in there from Graham Bell, who's the CEO of three wing Army Air Corps, it is at the time in Aden, and he basically sums up what the difference is. And he says, you know, the Army aviation has to be right at the front line, as close as it's safe to be, has to know where everybody is and feel the pulse of the battle all the time to do what it does. And that's the difference, you know, and that's no disrespect to the RAF helicopters or certainly not to the Royal Navy helicopter force either, because they do their bit, and the Royal Marines. But it's critical to the success of Army aviation that they are where they are. Otherwise, they're just not going to be able to do what they do.
Yeah, yeah. And there is a fair bit of coverage in the book of Indonesia, Borneo, you mentioned, and places like that. As the Army Air Corps was part of the last vestiges of British involvement in there, did that have any effect on the Corps continuing to grow? Because it's grown quite considerably. I know it's been through lots of defence reviews. But as these places disappeared off the UK map, as it were, the protectorates and things like that were handed back, how did the Army Air Corps then shrink or grow? How did that sort of work?
Well, you're right, because it proves itself each time. And obviously, to use the old term, aviation is a force multiplier. So if you're perennially trying to do more with less, then you want mobility and you want mobile firepower. So the Army, that helps the Army Air Corps. Certainly later on in Volume 2, we'll get into that, where the rest of the Army is downsized and the Army Air Corps in the 90s expands.
Yeah.
Creates a new regiment with Apache on the horizon, and it's like, okay, we need to be able to do that, you know. And you're talking, you know, you're looking at attack helicopter and all these things. But even in the 80s, each armored division in Germany had an aviation regiment of three aviation squadrons and a
headquarters squadron. Yeah, Mike, can you just tell us how the Army Air Corps is structured and how it evolved? Because you're mentioning lots of squadron numbers and regiments, and that's so different to, I suppose, most people's familiarity of flying squadrons and wings.
So if you think about flights and squadrons are the same as Air Force terminology. So a squadron would normally be a dozen or so aircraft. A flight would be about six. So a flight would be six. And of course, like most air organizations, combat operations would involve aircraft working in pairs at least. So you start off with a pair, flight of six, squadron of 12 or more, and then an Army Air Corps regiment, which would be an RAF wing, I guess. But the difference being that they fight together, whereas an RAF wing could be employed on different ops and tasks. An Army Air Corps regiment, we tried to be wings and all that. We said, no, it's Army. So was three flying squadrons, a headquarters squadron, which is the combat support and echelon fuel, weapons, etc., and a REMI workshop, which is your technicians and mechanics. So that was how it used to be. That's changed now with Apache, because the firepower Apache is two squadrons in a regiment, but they're of eight Apache. But they're still regiments, so it's because we speak Army.
Yeah. And I was going to say, how does the Army Air Corps culturally fit into the Army then? Because the Army is steeped in tradition going back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. I know you've got and have had some involvement with the Royal Anglian Regiment, for example, a great history around that regiment. Yeah. How does the Army Air Corps culturally fit into the Army coming through what is 60, 70 sort of years of
Interesting, isn't it? Because when I first joined in 1980, the nickname was Teeny Weeny Airways. And joking, it was friendly banter. We were what was called a combat support arm. So we were like the engineers, or we went front line. It was always, well, when everything else fails, the Army Aircorps will stop them. You know, they'll go and plug a gap, whatever it is. It was never second rate. I think we were always appreciated, but it was always, but, you know, I always used to have a bit of banter with the parachute regiment, saying, we were formed before you were, or whatever. And even the Royal Anglians, in its current guise, we were older than they are. So you could always stand your own. And the Blueberries, as through the 80s, as more and more people became direct entry and more of our officers progressed to higher rank, to one-star and two-star rank, then things began to change.
Yeah.
And, you know, the biggest change, I have to say, is the attack helicopter Apache, you know, because the Army Air Corps is now a combat arm alongside the infantry and the Armoured Corps. So everybody looks at the Army Air Corps now after Afghanistan, and it's like, yeah, combat arm. So I think much more, it's changed a lot over its history since 57.
And, you know, with the greatest respect, you've seen a lot of that evolution in your service, and you mentioned Northern Ireland, and for me, my memory of the Air Corps, that's where that starts. You know, as a nipper watching the news, you know, those helicopters were Army helicopters that were operating in Northern Ireland. How critical was this role to the ground forces, and what was it like for you having operated under those rather testing conditions?
Well, of course, and John was a pilot in city flight, so he spent his time over Belfast City in a helicopter tracking, you know, all kinds of people. But for me, it was door gunning out of Ballykelly and Aldergrove and South Armagh. And in those days, this is, of course, before Gulf War One and Gulf War Two and proper war fighting. You know, that was your operational tour, you know. And when the IRA had 12.7 machine guns and got hold of Stinger missiles, it was all very real. And their primary targets were helicopters. So, it got interesting. But helicopters were absolutely critical to everything the Army did in Northern Ireland. And I think that's part of that process where you just alluded to, where the rest of the Army, like, yeah, we like that. Because there's always that thing about the different sets of flying regulations and how the three services operated their helicopters. Well, the Navy could do anything because they had to fly in all weathers at sea, so they could go anywhere in any weather. The Army would be not too far behind. You know, and that thing about, I know what it's like to be dropped off in the wrong field. I know how picked up to get out. And the support helicopters had a different attitude altogether and different regulations. So that really played itself out, I found. And certainly you felt as an Army Air Corps soldier in Northern Ireland, you were playing a really important role.
Just personally, and I don't want you to cross any boundaries you don't want to, what sort of experiences did you take from that theatre?
From what, Northern Ireland?
Yeah. For you personally.
You did feel like you were making a difference in Northern Ireland. And things like the dynamite run where you had to deliver dynamite to quarries to allow blasting, but you couldn't stay there overnight because in case the terrorists got hold of the dynamite. So you flew it in. They used it and you flew it. So you were flying around Northern Ireland with underslung load of dynamite and everybody knew it. And it's always quite funny because the Ulster Constabularies would always do a breakfast when you land and say, hey, you better have this, might be your last one, sort of joking. So it was always good stuff like that. And, you know, working in South Armagh when the guys needed support, and it was really important. It was very satisfying.
One of the things that area of operations gave to the British Army was a skill set that really made them almost a premier service in the world in terms of anti-terrorism activities. And was that something that the Army Air Corps was able to use in some of those later theatres, like Iraq and Afghanistan.
I certainly remember an incident in Afghanistan where British Apaches took over from US Apaches, and yeah, the atmospheric, we were watching what's going on in an area, and the pilots of our two Apaches on station at the time all had Northern Ireland experience, quite senior pilots, and they were things like observing, why is there a tarpaulin on the back of that flatbed, and why is that pickup truck doing that? So that pattern of life stuff, they were doing it instinctively, which you know, other nations didn't have that experience, so therefore not that skill set. So certainly. And that command and control ability of multiple aircraft formations, which had been picked up in Northern Ireland and in Bosnia in the air mobile air assault role, was very evident in both Iraq and Afghanistan.
Any favorite anecdotes from the book that you particularly enjoyed writing about?
Some of the stuff in the Aden chapter. So the Kuwait one, Operation Vantage in 1961, when the first time Iraq threatens to invade Kuwait, and the Army Air Corps sent out this group of pilots to take over the Kuwait Flying Club, who have some civilian osters there. So they can't get aircraft in there, and they rush in and get these civvy osters and fly them down to patrol the border, and all that. And they're, you know, they're wearing typical Arab headgear to do it, and all that. It's just great boy's own stuff, and they do the job and they do it well. And you know, things like, for your listeners, things like, imagine, so a guy called Nick Nichols, who was in the glider pilot regiment after the war and was very well known to many of the Army Air Corps, very dapper, proper retired lieutenant colonel, he flew a beaver from Middle Wallop to Aden on his own.
Wow.
You know,
yeah,
things like that. Okay, well, you put that beaver down to Aden, off you go. One of the other stories is when we were pulling out the last days of Aden, the last aircraft out were beavers, and they put down, one of them goes US with oil over the windscreen, and they land in, I think it's Djibouti or somewhere like that, and the natives are not friendly, and there's AK-47s being pulled out left, right, center, and they have to call up the RAF, and an RAF Hawker Hunter appears overhead and is circling overhead the whole time until they can get out. You know, and prior to that, they, you know, there's all these liaison and exchange officers serving with the local Aden police and militias, and they've got to get them out. And they've got Sabi radios, search and rescue beacon radios, and it's like, basically the beaver will come and get you, but you need to hold out long enough in your room with your pistol or whatever, and we'll. It's like Northwest frontier stuff, you know. And of course the gunship stuff in Aden. But John did some great work about flying in Borneo and in Indonesia.
Yeah, there's some great, great stories in there and anecdotes in the book. I think the term you used earlier, and again, I wouldn't want to belittle it, but boy's own stuff sort of thing, is it's quite fascinating to see this, quite the seat of the pants flying and ops that were going on at a time when really we all thought that stuff was well and truly behind us.
You're right, and that's the phrase I was just about to use, seat of the pants, because, you know, as I said earlier, the RAF at the time were going for unmanned aircraft and rockets and all of that stuff, you know, and we're still not there, are we? But at the time, I thought, and it's back to Royal Flying Corps, you know, one guy in a single-engined aircraft over the jungle, over the desert, over the mountains, wherever, with a map on their lap, you know, and some of the humour, you know, there's one guy in Aden is flying a dead body back to base, and what he doesn't realise is it's not strapped in properly, and halfway through the flight in the dark, the arm of the body leans across and lands on his shoulder, and he almost crashes the aircraft in shock. It's the same with stuff, you know. And that's why we wrote it, because it's about ops normal. It's about the operational stuff, and there's the ground crew element to it as well, the things they go through, and flying into sewers, because when they're flying into sewers right at the start, there's no grid, no maps. They're doing it with no maps, And there's, where's the drop-off point? And it's like, okay, there's a statue at the mouth of Suez. My mother-in-law sent me a postcard. I remember where it is. Let's go.
Yeah.
And then the fire there as well. It's just...
And I think if nothing else from the book, it's just anecdote after story after story that brings that service to life and makes it such a fascinating read. What's next then, Mike? This is volume one and takes us to 2017 and looks at those hot and those hot environments. What's next in terms of the authorised operational history of the Corps?
So volume one, which is in print now, it really gets up to the end of the 70s and very early 80s. And that takes you through to the Scout being established, the Beaver replacing the Oster, and Northern Ireland is really going on a big scale. And we mentioned the Cold War, that's how it happened. But really, volume two is going, it is the Balkans. You know, the Army Air Corps is involved in Bosnia, all for UN and for NATO. Kosovo from Macedonia, all of that. Then Gulf War One, Operation Granby, 1991, which is the Army Air Corps going to war as a regiment for the first time. You know, three squadrons, four backup elements, etc. In a war fighting role in an armoured desert battle with 4 Regiment Army Air Corps. And John was out there with the RCT, I was there with 4 Regiment. And then we've got, obviously, the Balkans in between. Northern Ireland ongoing, getting some really serious, complex operations in Northern Ireland. And then Gulf War II in 2003, Operation Telic, and also the enduring operations after that, the Roulement tours when the squadron stayed and all the troops were drawn after the war fighting finished, and then that continuation and all that really hot, sticky, horrible, complex fighting in Basra, around Basra and all of that. And then obviously after that into, we've got Sierra Leone, Operation Barras. We've got Afghanistan, the advent of Apache on operations.
Mm-hmm. And when's that likely to when we likely to see that?
It'll be with the publish with Helion by the end of the year. So probably this time next year, we'll be talking about it. It's just about to come out. So
we're back on then. But volume one, 350 plus pages, I think. It's quite tight print. And I say that because there's a lot of information in there. But it doesn't read like a dull history. It reads like a fast fire set of anecdotes from around the world. And if you're interested in history itself, it's quite, you do blend quite nicely the Corps' history with world history, so it puts it in context. So it's a thoroughly enjoyable read. Where can we find out a little bit more about the book, Mike? Where can we find out about the book and you online?
So you can go to the Army Flying Museum at Middle Wallop and buy one, or you can go online on Amazon or anywhere. But it's published by Helion, and got to thank Duncan Barnes, who was behind all this, because when we went in with the idea, I said to him, I had very strong views on the format. And I'm really glad to hear you say that it's accessible, because that's what we wanted. Because John, as I said, John has got the academic bit squared away. We're both historians, but we were both very aware that we want to make it readable and accessible to all. So you can get it online. You can get it from Helion themselves.
I'll put links in the show notes to all of those places, and also to our bookshop as well. Where can we find you online, Mike?
I haven't got a website as such, but I'm on social media.
Yeah,
I'm on X, Mike, and also I do the Mighty Eighth podcast as well, so you can find me on.
Coming to that, I wanted to ask you about that.
We don't have a website as such, but you can find us via Helion and even the Army Air Corps, to be honest.
Okay.
But if any of your listeners have got Ben Kite's really good history of the Royal Air Force, ours is the same format, because that's when I went to Duncan. I said, I've seen, helped point Ben Kite out with the glider bits of his RAF history. And when it came out, I was like, if I do an official history, I want it to be, you know, if Carlsberg did an official history, it's so easy. So that's the format we went for. And John and I both agreed on that.
So you mentioned your careers as well, and you're steeped in history, both of you, particularly Second World War. You mentioned battlefield tours and things like that. What I didn't know until quite recently is you also produce the fabulous 8th Air Force, the 8th podcast. Tell us about that, because we want to get you back to talk a bit more about that in some detail.
Okay, yeah. So it's called the Mighty 8th podcast, and it's myself and a guy called Johan Tasker, and Johan is a journalist for Farmers Weekly. But we both live in East Anglia, as does John actually, and we developed this interest way before Masters of the Air in all the airfields. So those who live in East Anglia will know you're tripping over 8th Air Force and Bomber Command airfields wherever you go. So we started to talk about it, and I wrote a book about 381st called Bomb Group with Paul Bingley. And he came to me and said, I've got this idea for a podcast. And I said, well, what's a podcast? And so we went through that, and so we started to talk about that. So we've now done, I think, about 13 different podcasts about different aspects of the 8th Air Force. Some of them are about raids, some of them about crashes or capabilities. One of them is about B-17 versus the B-24, which one would you fly and
but
all
why,
that.
Why the Mighty 8th? Why did it? Was it just because you were all that way? You lived that way? It was surrounded?
I've been fascinated with it for a long time, and I just thought, RAF Bomber Command and Fighter Command is absolutely saturated with people who write about it. And although there's a lot about the 8th Air Force, you know, I can feel it. I live amongst it. And I was doing battlefield tours around the airfields, etc. I'd done Bomb Group with Paul Bingley. And I thought, I'd like to do more. So, and Johan came for advice. And we started talking, and he phoned me the next day and said, I've been thinking about this. Why don't we do this together, you know, and you do the history and I'll do the tech. So that's what we've done, and it's great fun, and it's got a lot of followers in the States, and it's
yeah.
It's
how are the Americans take into it? You know, a Brit talking about the Mighty 8th.
Well, it's really interesting because we said that when we did the Bomb Group book, two Brits writing about the 381st. You know, and a lot of the reviews from Americans didn't expect this from the Brits. And actually, to tell you the truth, I do a lot of tours for World War II Museum from New Orleans when they come over. I did the last one with Don Miller, and they are blown away by how interested the Brits are who run these bomb group museums scattered all over the country. The American Air Museum at Duxford, all of these places, you know, the 95th at Horam, the 100th Bomb Group at Thorpe Abbot, all these different places we go, Framlingham, Parham. So, and they go away really happy because they think their heritage is being looked after, because so many of them don't actually understand what went on over here and how integral the impact that the 8th Air Force had on the British community, British people.
Yeah, well, fascinating. So we're going to get you back. We've got a lot more to talk about. So be excited to do that. I was going to say in the new year. We are in the new year, aren't we? in a little while, when you get a bit more time. So, Mike, really enjoyed that. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you. And on behalf of John Greenacre and I, thank you very much for having us on.
Oh, that's wonderful. We'd like to thank Mick Oakey at the Aviation Historian for their support, and we'd also like to thank White Hearts for our music. I'd like to say a special thank you to Duncan Rogers at Helion Books for putting us in touch with Mike and John to set this up for us. So thanks very much, Duncan. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on social media, and you can find Ellie, Tim and Gareth on the extended social feeds. We're now on Instagram, Facebook, Threads, Blue Sky, LinkedIn and Twitter X. And with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Mike.
Yeah, good night. Goodbye, everyone.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is Aerospace Radio Station Extended. legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The program's produced with a Creative Commons license.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our program and broaden its reach. You can also review the program and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended.
Extended.
This is XTP Media.